Oh, I see. It's not. I see. Sorry, go ahead.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Willis here on behalf of Petitioner Millard Refrigerated Services. Seated at council table to my right is Caitlin Whiteside. Caitlin is a second-year law student at the University of Virginia who is particularly interested in OSHA matters, and she is clerking with a firm, and that is why she is here, and I'm glad she's able to be here. May it please the court, the Occupational Safety and Health Act in allowing a citation issued to an employer to be enforced requires three essential elements. One, that there is, in fact, a violation of the cited standard.
Counsel, but at the outset, weren't you asked to address a question?
Are you talking about the question of regarding the use of acronyms? If you would like me to address that now, Your Honor, yes, I will do that. I understand from having read the rule and reread the rule again prior to this argument that acronyms are allowed in this circuit, provided the use of a glossary, but that their use should in fact be limited to those that are most commonplace, like an agency name or FOIA. In reading back through Petitioner Millard's briefs, I do see the use of, as someone who's having lived this case for about 2.5 years, I can see where the use of terms such as PSM for process safety management or PHA would not be considered common parlance, and for that I apologize and defer to the court.
Just use the term training, or you can use, there's all kinds of language you can use that's just plain English. It makes it a lot easier to judges who don't live in the intricacies of OSHA.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand, and particularly I think your point is well made in a case such as this one where process safety management and is nothing but technical.
The terms bureaucrats come up with are unbelievable.
He's not accusing you of being a bureaucrat. He's going to save that for the other side.
Yeah.
No. I didn't come up with those terms, so I don't take it that way. But Your Honor, I fully understand, and I think beyond using terms such as Environmental Protection Agency or others.
EPA. You can use APA. There's a few other, NLRB you can use. Yep.
OSHA.
OSHA, yeah, I guess you use.
Okay.
OSHA's okay.
Sir?
OSHA's okay.
OSHA's okay. Well, and again.
But process safety management, PSM. What? I thought that was some kind of disease.
It may be by the time I'm done with it, but and to me, and like I said, having lived this, process safety management, of course, under OSHA's regulations is a very specific, very defined term that has many subparts, and I can see where when busy judges such as yourself who hear all forms, types of cases, and administrative appeals, that would not be clear, and for purposes of clarity in the brief, that may not be clear.
I ask you a question of sort of substance. What's at stake in this case? Suppose, is it just the amount of money that's, because it doesn't seem like there's an enormous amount of money to take the case to the Court of Appeals. What's at stake?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and one I was almost certain that you would ask. There is not
You knew
he was going to ask about the acronyms.
I knew he was going to ask about the acronyms, of that
so
I could
did
be
we.
Certain. There is not a lot at stake. As you know, the original citations were around $52,500 after administrative law judge, not ALJ, administrative law judge Welch decision. The amounts were reduced to somewhere around $15,000. So money is not, in fact, the issue. The issue is that the petitioner strongly believes that the remaining citations are not supported by the elements needed to support enforcement or affirmance of the citations.
Well, I'm asking, is there some kind of prejudice to the company in the future if there are these citations? I'm trying to figure out why.
I will be glad to address that, in particular because Millard Refrigerated Services is subject to OSHA's process safety management guidelines. They are also subject to the EPA's process safety management guidelines.
Are there some tort claims out there arising out of this, related to this, that this might impact on in some way? Or?
There are arising out of the August 23rd, 2010 ammonia release. Mm-hmm. There are also dealings with the Environmental Protection Agency, and I'm not an EPA lawyer, so if you ask me about
what does the EPA's have to do with OSHA's? I mean, do they follow on OSHA's? Does it?
I believe that they can at least look to OSHA. And OSHA's process safety management standards or regulations and what they actually do require are very similar in some aspects to those to what EPA requires.
But there's no particular prejudice that the company faces going forward beyond the fine that they pay here. Is that correct? So all at stake is $15,000. I don't mean to suggest that means you shouldn't appeal. I'm just curious.
Money is at stake, but also their future, how they apply the process safety management program at that facility, the Theodore, Alabama facility, as well as facilities nationwide, I believe is at stake.
Right,
and particularly with
Go ahead and make your substantive argument. I was just curious.
No, it is a very, very valid question.
So your point would be that if we rule in your way, that the agency can, that the companies can stop, for example, providing these swing gates, and they can stop requiring people to wear SCBAs when they go near ammonia, and that's what you want. That's why.
Not at all, Your Honor. I think what we're advocating for is for you give the example, and I'll address it first of the swing gates. Millard actually put up the swing gates as soon as the compliance safety and health officer looked up and said, you might want to put in some gates, but I'm not going to cite you for it. That part won't change, but what is important to them is in that regard is the fair notice and...
Well, there's a regulation on swing gates.
There is a regulation on swing gates.
Isn't that fair notice?
That is fair notice, but it becomes an issue when OSHA's been out there three separate times or two separate times in the past.
Estoppel doesn't work in this environment, right? I mean, we've never allowed a regulated entity to escape their responsibilities based on that, have we?
Well, I know in the Cedar case that's cited by the Secretary that OSHA was allowed to escape with it, but it was because the employer had not been cited in the past. And I think this is a little different situation, because not only had the company not been cited in 2007 during the comprehensive inspection in August 2010, but they had also been told by the compliance safety and health officer, Mr. Kratopoulos, that they would not be cited for it. Just fix it, and they said, okay.
This is a matter of actually the national federal law. More than OSHA, and the Supreme Court has indicated that almost flatly said there is no estoppel against the government because some subordinate official says X and then you're charged with Y. My recollection of that case is one justice, I believe it was Justice Kennedy, was almost willing to go as far as the majority there and say no estoppel, but he said hardly ever. He wasn't quite willing to, but the point is that under the Supreme Court law, it's very doubtful that there's ever a estoppel against the government.
I understand that to be.
And certainly not in a situation like this. You know, I mean, we would never recognize a estoppel on the grounds that one inspector came up and he didn't say anything about a violation, but the second inspector said, I saw the violation. We would never recognize that.
And, Your Honor, even if you would not recognize estoppel in that context, I think this is significant with regard to these particular swing gates when you go to the required element of employer knowledge.
No. Your second argument that it's hazardous to have the swing gate?
No, actually, I'll be glad to address that if Your Honor would like me to.
Did you make that argument?
The greater hazard argument? Yes.
Yes. It would be hazardous to have the swing gate because somebody coming up with a package
of tools
would have difficulty
taking their hands off the ladder and opening the swing gate.
But isn't that a policy call whether or not having the swing gate protects people from falling off is a greater danger than someone coming up with the toolbox? Isn't that just a policy call? Would you expect us to object to OSHA's regulation on that basis?
When, as here, I believe that the facts bore out and what OSHA had in the way of evidence bore out that the hazards of complying with the regulation, i.e. having the swing gates, were more dangerous than not having it. And that was borne out by the fact that there were employee safety complaints after the installation of the gates, which, of course, they, the company went ahead and did. And where alternative means had been used and had been used safely, I mean, I think that that clearly meets the greater hazard defense.
I thought the regulation has a specific alternative means using offsets, and that was not used.
You're correct. Offsets were not used.
And did you put in any evidence that offsets are a greater hazard?
No, sir.
Well, then you have a regulation that says if you don't like swing gates, use offsets, and you have an opportunity to argue, I guess, greater hazard, but you didn't. So why isn't that the end of that one?
I believe that the because the way I read the regulation, Your Honor, it allows either alternative means were used or were unavailable, and an alternative means was used.
But it tells you which kind of alternative means you have to show were unavailable. And you didn't show that. There's just no evidence about that at all.
I'm there with you, Your Honor.
Right. Let me just one second. I just loop back for one second on the estoppel question. The inspector who said, I'm not going to cite you for the swing gates, just fix this. Is this after the ammonium disaster or before?
It was actually after what happened.
So it's totally irrelevant, right? If it was after.
It was part of the group of the same citations that arose out of what happened was there was a second or subsequent inspection on the basis of an EPA referral that occurred in December 2010 after the release.
Was that after you got the citation, these citations, or not?
They were issued as part of the same citations.
No. When you were saying that the company didn't know that this was a violation, and you gave two reasons. One reason was there had been a previous inspection and the inspector didn't say anything. And then you said there was also an inspection in which the inspector said, I'm not going to cite you, just fix it, right? Is that what you said? Maybe I misunderstood.
If I may briefly clarify,
yes.
There was a 2007 inspection which had nothing to do with the ammonia release in which Millard wasn't cited. There was a comprehensive inspection that took place in August 2010 over multiple days with two compliance officers. Nothing was said. And then in December 2010, there was a follow-up inspection on the basis of an EPA referral, which included one of the two compliance officers from the August 2010 inspection.
What was the date of the ammonium
release?
Yes.
August 23rd, 2010.
Okay. And when was this inspector who said... August 23rd. When was this inspector who said that I'm not going to cite you, just fix it? When
December 2010, on or about December 10th, 13th, 2010.
So it was before August 23rd.
No, after.
Said December?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Yes,
so
Your Honor.
This is something that happened afterwards, so that couldn't possibly be estoppel, and it couldn't possibly have misled the company into believing it didn't need swing gates before the event. It's just... There's a inspector who said, right? I understand your argument, although I think it's a pretty uphill claim that the first inspector who just didn't see the swing gates has stopped you. But the second argument, which is an inspector who came in afterwards, after the event had already occurred, I stopped the government. I don't see how there's an estoppel there, even an argument about estoppel.
Well, I believe that, and I think that the case law supports that it was the lulled into compliance issue.
But how were you lulled into compliance by something that happened after the event had already occurred?
You mean after the release?
Yes.
Well, the swing gates really had nothing to do with the release or prevention of a future release or addressing or countermeasures for the release.
What was the date on which these swing gate citation that you are objecting to here, citation 1, item 1?
It was in February 2011. It was issued along with the remainder of the citations.
So that inspector who came in and said, I'm not going to cite you, but fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Did he say, I'm not going to cite you because it's not a violation? And I want you to fix it just for the heck of it? Or did he say, it's a violation, but I'm not going to cite you? What did he say?
In reading back through his testimony, and he said he was actually standing in the parking lot with another employee smoking. He pointed up to it. He said, I think you need to fix those swing gates up there. I'm not going to cite you for it, but fix it.
So that's not a representation that you weren't violating the regulation. That's a representation that I'm going to go easy on you.
It's mercy.
Right.
The Department of Labor is to stop any time an inspector uses mercy.
No, Your Honor, I believe that in combination with the failure to cite on two previous occasions, which also included the same compliance officer, those totality of those circumstances is different than just showing mercy.
Let me give you a hypothetical. I'm driving 50 miles an hour,
yes, obviously,
or 45 miles an hour. Actually, nowadays, maybe 30, 40 miles an hour on Connecticut Avenue. They put up a sign that says 35 miles per hour. There's a police car. He's looking at me. I'm looking at him. He waves. I wave. I keep going. I see that I violated it. The next day, I'm driving down. A different police car. Police car comes, stops me, and says, hey, you're over the speed limit. And I say, oh, please, officer, don't cite me. And he says, okay, but don't do it again. Now, does that give me the right to speed as much as I want down Connecticut Avenue? Because one, a police officer intentionally let me go, and second time, a police officer showed me mercy.
First of all, I would never be driving that slow, so I your restraint.
Let me just also say there are cameras there, so you probably would be.
I actually probably would be, but I think the situation is different here, too, because when Millard is charged with, or actually when the secretary has to prove employer knowledge to assess a violation, and the secretary is going to say, that was in plain view, but by the way, we didn't notice it, guys, and when we noticed it, we said, just fix it. I do believe that's an issue. I think that's different from your speeding
example.
What
is the right of the inspector to say fix it if it's not because it needs fixing under the regulations?
Well, he is allowed to cite for things that he sees or addresses. That's part of an OSHA inspection.
Right, that violate regulations.
Or that he believes to present a hazard otherwise.
So that kind of did put you on notice.
At that point in time, but not beforehand.
Okay.
Can I ask one question? You've got a whole series of issues raised. What is your strongest argument? What is the most important issue that you want to bring to our attention?
Thank you for asking that question, because there are a whole host of issues, and I believe that the two most important issues address with the two process safety management violations. Very briefly, one, the violation of 29 CFR 1910.119E3, subpart 3, regarding the identification of any previous incident that had a likely potential for catastrophic consequences.
2007.
The 2007 release.
That's what you're concerned.
That was the concern of that, the identification, because it was identified by a serial or an identification number, and the concern being that
the appendix.
The concern being that
that's your number one issue.
That's my number one issue.
What's your number two issue?
Number two issue would be that the other process safety management violation, 1910.119G3, regarding an employer ascertaining that employees involved in the process have received and actually understand training. The citation is clearly based on an interview that was conducted of this plant engineer, Mr. Alan White, in which he was double-teamed with two compliance officers but not allowed to refer to documents which he used in his day-to-day work in use of terms like MOC, PSM, PHA, and those terms that I will never put in acronym form again.
Well, it wasn't so much about the terms. That wasn't what he was questioned about. It's what you do in certain circumstances. When do you put a stop on the valves? When do you do this? When do you do that?
Well, I understand that part of his not hitting the e-stop or emergency stop button.
No, wasn't that the kind of questions you were asked? It wasn't, do you know what PSM means?
In fact, actually, he was asked, do you know what MOC means?
Oh, my God.
Do you know what...
But
the real... rule against acronyms?
The real concern was whether he knew what to do when there was an emergency.
And I believe a secondary part of the basis that I understood from hearing and the evidence presented throughout in the Secretary's argument was the fact that Mr. White did not, in fact, hit the emergency stop button during the August 23, 2010 release. But that does not demonstrate a lack of training. And, in fact, his superior said, even though a company report cited it one thing, it would have taken longer to valve off the release had Mr. White gone to turn off the e-stop button. And I just
So is your argument that he made a considered judgment and it was the right call not to turn off the button? Is that
That is an argument that, yes, it is. And I think that I don't think it's enough to base to concede or to demonstrate that he did not, in fact, under the
standard
training.
I thought your strongest arguments actually had to do with the OSHA 300 log citations. So remind me what your argument is there.
The 300 logs?
Yeah.
The purpose of 300 logs is, and I think this is the basis of any of those arguments, is to inform the employer of the types of injuries or lost time, days away from work, that have occurred so that further injuries, illnesses may be addressed and prevented. Some of the citations that were listed on there are with that regard. For example, that an employee tore his pants leg doing something, but it didn't list that the employee had a contusion. The employer actually had an incident report that referenced in specific detail, so I think there was plenty of notice to the employer what had happened, and I don't think that's a strong enough basis for the citation. That particular citation, I think, and Millard was very much on notice of what its issues were with regard to employee illness and injury.
Now, the ALJ found that these were insufficient descriptions. I mean, you all offered some descriptions, but they were insufficient.
Insufficient descriptions. Mm-hmm. Yes, what they found.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I look at the log, you actually didn't describe the injuries in question. For example, with Mr. Johnson, left knee, pant leg got caught under wheels, but you don't describe the injury.
The injury is described in a separate incident report that the employer keeps. It's not on a 300 log.
Uh-huh. But I mean, the log itself calls for description of the injury, and that wasn't done. Is that what the ALJ was saying?
That's how the ALJ ruled.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we'll hear from the other side.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Ron Gottlieb for the Secretary of Labor. I apologize for the use of unfamiliar acronyms in our briefs. Returning to the merits of the case, I'll address the stop log just very briefly because the Court seems to understand. But the statement that they're relying on was at the inspection December 8th or 10th, but the violation is for the condition of the gates before then, you know, up till that point. So there's no reliance on the statement that could give rise to estoppel. It's not a situation where you say, we're not going to cite you, and then we come back a year later and cite you, which is what she's trying to suggest, but it's not really the case. The training item, let me switch to the 119E3II, which is the one for not considering the 2007 release when it conducted the process hazard analysis in 2010. They've argued in their reply brief that we didn't show that there's a likely probability of catastrophic consequences, but they waived that argument twice. They didn't raise it before the commission in their petition for discretionary review, and the court is not allowed to consider objections that aren't raised.
Say it again. Which specific argument was it that they didn't raise?
The argument that the secretary didn't prove that the 2007 event had the likely potential for catastrophic consequences. That those are the types of events that you have to consider at the process hazard analysis, and the ALJ found that the 2007 event had the likely potential for catastrophic consequences. They never challenged it in front of the commission, and therefore they waived it. They also didn't make the argument in their opening brief so they've waived it the second time. There is evidence to support that finding if the court has any questions about it, but I just wanted to put out the waiver argument because we haven't had a chance to address it.
Sorry, was this argument in their reply brief?
Right.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
The provision requires that the process hazard analysis address the identification of any prior incident. And that has two components. One, they have to identify the event, in this case the 2007 release, and two, they have to address it. In that sense, they have to analyze the event, they have to see if it requires any change in how they are addressing the hazards that arise from the process. And the ALJ found that they didn't meet the first requirement of identifying it. And substantial evidence supports that, because nothing in any of the documents that constitute the 2010 process hazard analysis identifies the 2007 event. Whether you look at either any page of the process hazard analysis individually or together, none of them tell the reader, you know, what happened in 2007, or that even that there was a release in 2007. They rely on the addendum that they did in 2007, but that doesn't mention the release, or it has this number, but the two people that were on the team that conducted the process hazard analysis in 2010 didn't recall anything about the 2007 release being discussed. And that shows that this addendum didn't bring home to them that they were considering the 2007 release. And that has consequences, because when they did the incident report in 2007, they noticed that a computer error was also part of the problem. And the addendum doesn't talk about the computer problem. So if they had known that they were talking about the 2007 release, they might have known, well, there's a computer problem that we need to address and talk about. So there's really no basis for questioning the ALJ's determination that they didn't identify the 2007 incident when they conducted their process hazard analysis in 2010. Regarding the training, there's several aspects of the record that show that the engineer did not understand his training in process safety management. They didn't throw out acronyms. They asked him about basic concepts of the process safety management. In addition, he didn't understand. He wasn't able to
understand if they had questioned him for to his understanding of the acronyms.
My understanding is that they didn't use
it. Would be reversed.
I think we'd have it'd be.
No.
It'd be a different case, yeah, no. I don't think they didn't test them on the acronyms. They tested them on the concepts. In addition, their own report shows that he didn't know how to achieve safe startup of the after the power outage. And that's one of the items that he was trained on. And he didn't...
Is that the lotto, the logo?
No, that's lockout, tagout.
Okay.
I'm sorry, that was a different item. He also... probably didn't know what valves to turn off. That's why they delegated.
Yeah, that was the key problem.
Yeah, that was somebody. He had to have somebody else do it. And we also think.
What about the argument the company makes is you can't blame him. He was in training.
He'd been in training for a long time, and he had been
5 years, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he had been an operator at least from 2008. So, and he had supposedly been trained in all of these items since 2008. I don't know what different duties he had in 2010 that required more additional training, but he had been an operator for a while. He was an operator at that time, and he didn't understand the training. And the argument about pressing the e-stop, and there's no reason that they couldn't have done both. They could have isolated the valves, and he went to the engine room where the e-stop was while the other people was isolating the valves. He still could have pressed the e-stop, and that, according to their own report, would have limited the damage that occurred as a result of the incident. So there's a lot of evidence that he just didn't understand a lot of his responsibilities under the process safety management standard. I think the ALJ's findings that he didn't describe, they didn't describe the injuries is confirmed by their answer that they had this separate incident report that which it was never submitted into the evidence. We don't know it, but in any event, as Your Honor pointed out, the regulation requires it that it be on the log, and they didn't do that. I don't think I have any other points on anything that they discussed, unless the court has any.
Okay, thank you very much. Does the petitioner have any time? I will give you another 2 minutes if you'd like. But in that 2 minutes, the first thing I'd like you to address is this waiver question. Have you waived the argument about the 2000 event having likely potential for
I think death? I think so, and I think that was mentioned in the reply brief. It was an argument that was made before the ALJ, and I think in our brief to the OSHRC, and probably should not have been put in the it was actually addressed during the evidence. If you can read the interesting part of the record about the Walmart bottle of ammonia, but I won't bore you with the details there. I didn't bring it with me today. Don't worry about that.
You didn't bring the bottle or
the bottle.
Right, but you agree that this argument's waived.
I agree. Okay. I agree. That's not that's not the basis of the challenge there.
Okay.
It's not the basis of the challenge there. I did want to address briefly what the Secretary said about 1910.1193 in the subpart regarding identification of any incident which has the likely potential for catastrophic consequences and then the duty to address it. And the way I read their briefs and the way I read the regulations, the duty to address it and or follow up, do something about it, which really appeared to be OSHA's main concern, was how were they to follow up if this identification number didn't link up to a particular area, how would someone know to do anything about it? Those are contained in separate subparts of the regulation, Part E5 and E6, which Millard was not cited under. I'm not arguing that there's not a duty to do follow-up or even that there's any indication that follow-up was or was not done, but I think it's significant to note that Millard was not cited for violations of either of those two regulations, and I think that's an important point there. Unless the court has any further questions, I thank you very much.
Thank you, and we thank both sides very much. We'll take the matter under submission.